From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, is a popular athletic shoe company owned by the Klan? Is AIDS a government conspiracy to kill African Americans? We'll talk with Patricia Turner about her new study of rumors and conspiracy theories circulating in African American culture. Also, we'll talk with James Dickey. The poet and author of Deliverance has a new novel about a World War II tail gunner shot down in Japan. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of The Simpsons and the season finale of The Larry Sanders Show. And Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new jazz album by pianist Reginald Robinson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials in India now say up to 16,000 people have died in a major earthquake, and there's concern that figure may go higher. It's the worst earthquake there in more than 50 years. Andrew Whitehead reports for the BBC.
Night has now fallen over the stricken area. The Indian Army is using arc lights to try to locate survivors, but it will be dawn before the rescue operation can resume at full pace. Almost 3,000 bodies have been recovered, but government officials say the total number of dead is expected to be at least double that. And Indian state television is reporting that more than 10,000 may have been killed. The earthquake measured 6.4 on the Richter scale. The epicenter was in a poor sugar-growing area 500 kilometers east of Bombay. The houses of mud, stone and thatch collapsed in their tens of thousands. The first television pictures show rows of buildings all in ruins, corpses shrouded in sheets, and survivors looking utterly bewildered.
Andrew Whitehead reporting from New Delhi for the BBC. In Washington, Congress has approved $2.5 billion in new aid to Russia as part of a trimmed-down foreign aid package. The vote of 87-11 in the Senate came after the House approved the foreign aid measure. Congress has passed only 3 of 13 annual appropriations bills, and yesterday once again had to pass a stopgap measure to keep the government running at the start of the new fiscal year, October 1st. President Clinton today took another step in his effort to overhaul the federal government's rules and regulations. He signed an executive order calling for a review of all federal rules that affect business and industry that have contact with the federal government. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today's executive order is part of Clinton's effort to reinvent government. Clinton came into office criticizing the Bush administration's competitiveness council for providing a secret way for businesses to do end runs around government regulations. The president said today's order not only eliminates what he calls backdoor access for those who want to undermine the regulatory process, but it also directs the government to review all its regulations and to get rid of the ones that are useless or outdated.
This order will lighten the load for regulated industries and make government regulations that are needed more efficient. Most of all, it will put behind us the politics of adversarialism that has divided government and industry for too long.
The president had previously signed another executive order directing government agencies to eliminate 50% of all their internal regulations. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 11 points to close at 3,555.12 on volume of 281 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen has suspended five officials at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and replaced the head of the agency in the wake of a four-month-long investigation of a raid earlier this year on a Texas cult headquarters. Bentsen said commanders lost the element of surprise on those inside the compound near Waco, Texas, and should have canceled their raid, in which four agents died. The investigation of the raid criticized officials for poor planning, and then after it failed, hiding the truth. Bentsen says that further action will be taken in a number of personnel matters. The Senate has turned back an effort to kill the superconducting supercollider, a multi-billion-dollar physics experiment under construction in Texas. The vote means that this giant scientific project is likely to go forward. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Congressmen looking for ways to cut the federal budget have targeted the superconducting super collider, since it will cost at least $10 billion to build and billions more to operate. Earlier this year, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to kill the project, even though it's 20% complete. But the Senate has come to its rescue. The Senate Appropriations Committee voted to fund the collider, and today the full Senate turned back an attempt to kill it. The last major hurdle for the project this year is a conference committee made up of senators and representatives, and most of the members on that panel are sympathetic to the collider, which is to be the world's largest atom smasher. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
There are reports that Russian leader Boris Yeltsin has written Western leaders warning them against expanding NATO to former communist nations of Eastern Europe. The Reuters News Service is reporting that the Russian president says instead NATO and Moscow should guarantee jointly the security of Eastern Europe. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're probably familiar with plenty of conspiracy theories and with rumors about large corporations that are secretly controlled by Satanists and other evil forces. My guest Patricia Turner is a folklorist who is studying rumors and conspiracy theories circulating in the black community. There are rumors that certain fast food chicken franchises and athletic shoe companies are secretly controlled by the Ku Klux Klan. One conspiracy theory alleges that AIDS was created and spread by the government to kill off African Americans. Turner is a professor of African American and African Studies at the University of California at Davis. Her new book is called I Heard It Through the Grapevine. She told me about a rumor she calls Lights Out, which is now spreading around the country.
Well, it, like all rumors, exists in multiple versions depending upon where you hear it. Here in Northern California, most versions go that the upcoming weekend is gang initiation weekend, and that for the recruitees to get into the gang, they have to leave the inner city, they have to leave the hood, and drive at night with their lights out. When a car encounters them and flashes its lights using the standard driver courtesy to let them know their lights are out, they are to follow that car and eventually kill the driver when the opportunity presents itself. And then they will get into the gang. Here in California, the gangs that are identified are the Crips and the Bloods. But as I've talked to people in Detroit, Chicago, Washington, elsewhere, places where those gangs are not prominent in the news, it's another gang that's mentioned. Or in the case of Detroit, an informant told me that this was a new gang that wanted to establish its turf, and this was how it was going to initiate its members.
Now, how do you know that this is just a rumor?
Well, the police and journalists in all of the cities where the rumor has escalated, they have sources, they have informants in the gang world, and they're just as surprised by the rumor as the rest of us. The standard sources that the police rely upon have no reason to believe that this ritual has been designed and will be implemented.
Well, do you have any idea how a rumor like this gets started and how it spreads to cities around the country?
Well, that's always one of the first questions, and it's always one of the most difficult to answer. In the case of a rumor such as this one, there's certainly been a lot of attention to gangs in the news of late. There's certainly been a lot of attention paid to the assaults on foreign tourists in Florida. And I think that in our contemporary environment, gangs are the real bogeymen. They're the real nefarious bad guys out there. And I think that gangs make the news when their activities seem to be encroaching on the activities of the safe population. So all of these elements combine together in a very familiar rumor format or legend format is updated to fit the concerns of the time. In terms of how the rumors spread, the Lights Out is a particularly interesting example because these rumors have spread largely through fax machines, through email, so very modern technological grapevines. on the one hand, but other informants have told me about hearing it in very traditional ways. Again, my informant from Detroit was getting her braids done at a beauty parlor on Saturday, and the proprietor of the beauty salon was making a real point out of telling all of her customers not to flash their lights that weekend because of this upcoming initiation. So this rumor is traveling in very standard conventional ways, as well as utilizing, if you will, all of the modern technology available for communication today.
So if any of us hear this, we should be reassured it's just a rumor.
Right.
Let's move on to another kind of rumor. And there are a lot of rumors about different corporations saying that these companies are really controlled by the Ku Klux Klan. You've come across rumors like this with several major companies. Maybe you could run through what some of those companies are.
Okay, the first rumor I encountered connected the Church's Fried Chicken franchise to the Ku Klux Klan. And informants would tell me that the Klan owned Church's Chicken and that they put something in the recipe so that when black men ate the chicken, they were sterilized as a result of consuming the chicken. And people would verify this rumor in one of two ways. They would say they knew it was true because a friend had seen an expose on a television talk show, or that a friend had read it in the newspaper. Folklorists call these friends fofs, friends of a friends, because they're one step removed from the person who's usually telling you the rumor. Churches was one of the companies that confronted a KKK allegation. Reebok Athletic Wear, British Knights Athletic Wear confronted a KKK rumor, I think largely because of the Knights in the name British Knights. There was an association there. A little-known athletic wear company named Troop confronted this rumor. And what was interesting about the Troop example was people would say that the name of the product, Troop, stood for to rule over oppressed people, Troop. Another company that encountered the KKK allegation, probably the most recent example, is Snapple Iced Tea. And there was a great deal of media attention to that one. Informants would say that Snapple was owned by the Klan, and their proof was a K that's on the label, or the ship that's on the label of the Snapple Iced Tea bottle. People will say that that's that was a slave ship that is being celebrated in the label.
What does Snapple have to say about the K and the ship?
The Snapple Corporation took a very unusual stance. They bought advertising in major newspapers in Northern California where they thought the rumor was most popular, and categorically denied the association, categorically denied the rumor. Most companies who are targeted by these rumors prefer not to take such a public position. They like to let the rumors die on their own, or they think that the rumors will die on their own. And they're afraid that by mentioning it publicly, even in the course of a denial, that that will plant the rumor in the minds of people who haven't heard it before, and that they might choose to avoid their product.
Is there any pattern that you can fit the companies into who have been rumored to be affiliated with the Klan? Like, why those companies? Why are they chosen?
In looking at the companies, I've been able to isolate a few characteristics that seem to emerge across the board. Their products tend to be at the upper end of the price scale in that given group. For example, the Reebok cycles, and there were other cycles that Reebok was involved with that had to do with them supporting apartheid in South Africa. Those really flourished after the introduction of the pump basketball shoe, which at that time cost $175. So they were very much at the upper end of the price range. Well, Snapple Iced Tea is at the upper end of the beverage price range. Liz Claiborne Clothes, another company that's been accused of Klan affiliation. Liz Claiborne Clothes are at the upper end of the price scale.
How do these rumors actually affect behavior?
In some instances, the consumers will leave the products alone, certainly altogether. And a company like Troop went bankrupt shortly after the rumors gained popularity about its products. Now, they never connected their bankruptcy with the rumors. They always said that it was the fickleness of the fashion industry that contributed to the company's demise. But in point of fact, it did happen after the rumors were quite popular. I find many informants who, when I ask them if they believe the rumor, will say, well, it does seem a little bit far-fetched. And then I'll say, well, are you going to buy any more Church's Chicken or Reebok shoes or Liz Claiborne clothes? And they'll go, well, no, to be on the safe side, I'm not going to. So that behavior is affected even in people who ostensibly say that they don't believe the item.
My guest is Patricia Turner. She's an associate professor of African American and African Studies at the University of California at Davis. She's also the author of the new book, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Rumor in African American Culture. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Patricia Turner is with us. We're talking about her new book on the subject of rumor in African-American culture. Now, a lot of the rumors that you've been studying are really more like conspiracy theories, where the government or some government agency is perceived to have conspired to either have created the AIDS virus and planted it in the African-American community, or to have put liquor stores on every corner so as to weaken the black community. Do you want to mention some other rumors that fit into this cycle?
Another really prominent one, perhaps the one that was most easy for me to collect versions of, was that the government had either designed crack cocaine and intentionally put it in inner city areas and made it available, and the government's motive for this was to diminish the black population, or that the government, after crack became a drug of choice, allowed it to proliferate, did not extend itself in terms of controlling the drug or controlling the dissemination of the drug. Again, the government's goal in this being to allow blacks to die off.
Now, for anyone who's not familiar with these conspiracy theories, they might sound a little far-fetched, but they really have a very wide circulation, and some very, I think, influential people support them.
That's right. Many people hear these in the street, and they hear them in the beauty parlor, in the school, and so forth, but they also hear them from their ministers. They hear them from community leaders and community activists, from doctors. There are doctors who claim that AIDS was designed as a mechanism of genocide, medical doctors with all of the credentials. So very influential people have gotten on the bandwagon behind some of these.
And even a scene that you remind us of in your book from the movie Boys in the Hood furthers one of these theories. You want to very briefly describe the scene?
Yeah, in the film Boys in the Hood, the character Furious Styles is trying very hard to keep his son Trey on the straight and narrow, keep him headed towards college, keep him away from drugs. And if he can, he also wants to help Trey's friends, the other boys in the hood as well. He takes them to an empty lot where there had been a black business, I believe, and he starts talking about why these businesses were disappearing and the detrimental effect drug abuse was having on their community. And he starts to say, you know, you didn't see these drugs before, and where did our people get the planes to go to South America and get these drugs, and where did we get the laboratories to design these drugs? Don't you think that there's something more behind this? You shouldn't use these drugs because you're doing just what the man, meaning the white man, wants you to do when you do that.
I think the Tuskegee experiment figures into conspiratorial views, too.
Right. Very often when people are identifying a rumor or a contemporary legend and talking to me about it, they will verify the rumor or they will support the rumor by referring to very real, very accurate, very true stories and very true situations about African American history. The Tuskegee experiment is one of the best examples. For over 40 years, there was a cohort of African American men in the vicinity of Tuskegee, Alabama. And the Public Health Service had designed an experiment by which they wanted to see the effects of untreated syphilis on the body. So they told these men that they had bad blood, and they enticed them to participate in an experiment that lasted over 40 years. There was no comparable white study group, and even after the invention of penicillin and drugs that would have mitigated the effect of syphilis on these men, the experiment continued. And it wasn't a secret experiment. A lot of people think that this was some hush-hush secret experiment. All along, the researchers were publishing the results of their study in medical journals. It was well known within the medical community that this experiment was being conducted. And people thought that this was a perfectly acceptable enterprise to embark upon.
So the logic is if they could let the Tuskegee experiment happen, God knows what else they could try to do.
Exactly.
Now, what about other realities that might figure into conspiracy thinking, such as the reality that American intelligence organizations spied on civil rights leaders, spied on black militant leaders, infiltrated the organizations? Do you think that feeds those theories, too?
Oh, definitely. And in terms of the governmental conspiracy rumors, I'm very careful to say in my book and elsewhere that I can't get to the facts of these as easily as I can with the consumer items. It's much easier for me in researching the consumer items to figure out who owns a company and to figure out what's in Church's chicken and to figure out the basis for truth in these items. I don't know who designed AIDS. talk about a slip. I don't know where AIDS came from. I don't know where AIDS came from. I don't know what the exact source of that infection is. I don't know how drugs got into the African-American community. And there is only so far that I, as a scholar, can go in trying to get to that information. So I try to be very cautious in my book, not to say that I know for sure that there's no grounds for authenticity in these governmental conspiracy items.
But does it disturb you when somebody says with great conviction that they're sure that AIDS is a conspiracy on the part of the United States government to kill off the black population, that the AIDS virus was designed by the government for that purpose, and then it was put into the black community?
When I look at all of the things that we hear about AIDS, when you remember things like the African green monkey theory, that was a possible source of the virus, there's certainly enough information in the news that we are getting about AIDS that would lead a reasonable person to the conclusion that perhaps this is just another instance of the government being out to get a minority population. I think that the kinds of beliefs that most disturb me. I was on another radio call-in show, and a pediatrician called in who was trying to convince African-American parents in her area to get their children inoculated. And a rumor had sprung up that there was something in the inoculations that would lead their children not to be able to procreate, or that would damage their children. Now, this is, again, a very old one. When the Salk vaccine, the polio vaccine, first came out, doctors encountered this in the 1950s as well. And I think that that disturbs me when people are, and children are not getting inoculations because of a belief like this.
Do you try to talk people out of believing rumors, or do you see it as just your job to collect them?
It's just my job to collect them. I certainly talk to people, you know, in the process of an interview, people will say to me, you don't believe this, or you found out otherwise about this. And I'm always happy to share what I know up to a certain point with people. But I don't think it's my place to try to talk anyone out of a particular belief. For one thing, it's usually pretty futile. Once a person has decided that with a great deal of conviction about one of these things, there's very little I or anybody else could say that that will deter them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Patricia Turner. She's the author of the new book, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Rumor in African-American Culture. She's also an associate professor of African-American and African Studies at the University of California at Davis. There are lots of new TV shows premiering these days, but TV critic David Bianculli finds he's been most looking forward to new episodes of old favorites, such as HBO's The Larry Sanders Show, which ended its season last night, and Fox's The Simpsons, which begins its fifth season tonight.
What I love about these two shows in particular is how dense they are. Not dense stupid, dense rich. They're so loaded with pop culture references, anyone who watches Larry Sanders or The Simpsons is inundated with in-jokes. To get all the jokes, you're expected to be an amateur expert in all aspects of show business. And these days, most of us are. In tonight's season premiere of The Simpsons, the pace is set in the first few seconds, in the credit sequence where Bart always writes a different sentence on the detention room blackboard. This time he writes, "I will never win an Emmy." And the episode itself is about Homer's barbershop quartet, a group whose rise and fall closely parallels that of the Beatles. It's the best Beatles spoof since The Ruddles. And if the phrase, number nine, rings any bells, you'll be sure to appreciate the Simpsons version.
And where's Barney?
Oh, he's with his new girlfriend, the Japanese conceptual artist.
Barbershop is in danger of growing stale. I'm taking it to strange new places.
Number eight.
Over on The Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling has taken his role as a fictional talk show host and become TV's best talk show host this side of David Letterman. And here, too, the more you know about pop culture, the more there is to savor. In one recent episode, Rip Torn and Jeffrey Tambor, who play Larry's producer and sidekick, discussed the previous night's guest host performance by Martin Mull. It's a conversation where the line between fiction and reality doesn't even exist anymore.
What the hell did you say to Martin Mull last night?
Why?
Well, he quit. Because of you, I've got to scramble for a new guest host.
Yeah, well, you see, I could have seen that coming. And you know, see, he was fine on that make-believe talk show, that Fernwood thing, but, you know, you put him in the genuine article and he locks you.
Last night on Larry Sanders, for the season finale, Sanders echoed a classic moment from talk show history by shocking his staff and his viewers with a surprise announcement.
As many of you know, I've been in show business now for 20 years, which is a long and wonderful career. And what I'm trying to say is that this is the final Larry Sanders Show that you've watched tonight. And
even though this is just a fictional show, the effect was about as shocking as when Jack Parr walked off the real Tonight Show back in the early 60s. He returned after a brief stay away. And when Larry Sanders resumes in 1994, Sanders undoubtedly will too. Meanwhile, catch this cliffhanger, which will be repeated later this week on HBO, and then catch up with any reruns you may have missed. I think you'll agree that Larry Sanders, like The Simpsons, is way above par.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
With my baby.
I'd like to thank you on behalf of the group, and I hope we pass the audition.
I don't get it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If James Dickey hadn't served in World War II, he might never have become a writer. Coming up, he'll tell us why. Dickey is the author of the novel Deliverance, which he also adapted for the screen. His new novel, To the White Sea, takes place during World War II. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by Reginald R. Robinson, which mixes the oldest of ragtime themes with new piano compositions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. An earthquake that measured more than 6 on the Richter scale plunged India into one of its most serious natural disasters in this century early today. The earthquake shook buildings from their foundations throughout southwest India in the early morning. Authorities estimate that as many as 16,000 people may have died and that thousands more may be trapped under the remains of their homes and other buildings. Soldiers and police officers rushed to the remote area of southwest India with stretchers, tents, medical supplies, bulldozers, and mobile hospitals. The day after the Bosnian parliament effectively rejected a peace plan that would divide the country along ethnic lines, the army commander said his forces would observe a ceasefire in central and southern Bosnia. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Sarajevo.
General Razim Delić said he hopes Bosnian-Croat forces will also cease military activities, but he conceded that the unilateral ceasefire may be difficult to implement in areas where there has been fierce fighting between Muslim and Croat forces. General Delić also said that after the parliament's decision to demand the return of territories conquered by Serbs, there could be an escalation of Serb attacks in certain areas. And today's Sarajevo was on general alert after large-caliber shells hit the city. In Banja Luka, Bosnian Serbs convened their self-styled assembly to formulate their response to the parliamentary vote. Assembly President Momcilo Krasnik said Serbs had made territorial concessions at the last session of the peace talks in order to get the plan accepted and should now retaliate against the Muslim rejection by withdrawing their offer. This is Silvia Poggioli in Sarajevo.
The American Medical Association, the most powerful medical lobby in the country, has begun a campaign to change key elements of the president's health reform plan. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
The American Medical Association began expressing its doubts about the administration's health reform plan as soon as the president finished his health care speech last week. And yesterday, the organization sent out letters to the nation's physicians detailing its objections. It also sent over 600 doctors to Capitol Hill to lobby. While it approves of components of the president's plan, the AMA doesn't like his proposal to limit the cost of health insurance. It says an insurance cap will lead to rationing of care. The AMA is worried patients won't be able to afford to choose their own doctors. It wants the Clinton plan to include undocumented aliens, and the organization objects to the proposed requirement that medical schools produce more general practitioners. A White House spokesman says in response that the administration wants a health care system that works well for everyone, not just doctors. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
President Clinton says he has accomplished his goal of reducing the White House staff by 25%, and Mr. Clinton claimed today his White House is doing more work than his predecessors did with fewer people. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 11.18 points. This is NPR News in Washington. The country's first private school voucher program may be expanded to include religious schools, but not without a challenge. Marge Pitroff of member station WUWM reports.
4 years ago, Wisconsin became the first state to divert money from the public schools to hundreds of low-income Milwaukee parents who wanted instead to send their children to private non-sectarian schools. But today, the Landmark Legal Foundation, a nonprofit law firm in Washington, D.C., filed suit demanding that religious schools be included in the program. Excluding them, President Gerald Hill says, is a violation of the parents' constitutional rights.
You are limiting their choice solely on the basis of their desire to exercise their religion by choosing a religious school. That's a violation of the First Amendment.
Opponents are certain, however, the federal courts will continue upholding the separation of church and state. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Pitroff in Milwaukee.
Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson suspended five subordinates today who were involved in the deadly February 28th raid on the Waco, Texas religious cult. An investigation into the raid reported that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms officials had been less than truthful about their actions after the fact. The Treasury Secretary also replaced the director of ATF, who had said earlier this week he was resigning from the post. Benson said the officials, quote, obviously should have called off the raid since they had lost the element of surprise. Four alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents died in the raid, along with six members of the cult. A 51-day standoff that followed the raid came to a fiery conclusion in which more than 80 members of the cult died. The Senate has turned back an effort to kill a giant atom smasher being built in Texas. The fate of the superconducting supercollider project will now be settled in a conference committee. The House had voted overwhelmingly in June to kill the project. Critics contend it is nothing but a super pork barrel program spinning off jobs in 48 states. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In James Dickey's best-known novel, Deliverance, which he also adapted into a film, four suburban men take a canoe trip and find it's not the best way to relax. As if the wild rapids aren't enough, they're preyed on by demented backwoods men who rape them and then shoot them with bows and arrows. Dickey's new novel is also about being tested by the elements and preyed on by other men. To the White Sea is about an American tail gunner whose plane is shot down over Tokyo just before the firebombing of that city during World War II. He is alone in enemy territory. His instincts tell him to head north, to the wilderness, where it is too cold for most men to live, and he can be alone. The novel is about how he survives against his enemies and the elements. I asked James Dickey why he's so interested in that theme.
I have always been attracted to that element in fiction when someone else wrote it. And I'm not equipped to write novels of the higher crusts of society like Henry James or Edith Wharton or someone like that, or Lewis Auchincloss. I couldn't do it. I don't have the knowledge of it, and above all, I don't have the interest in it. But something like this I have a great interest in, a survival situation. The American poet Alan Tate once told me, he said, Jim, I sometimes think of my poems as commentaries on those human situations from which there's no escape. And I'm very sympathetic to that attitude, and that's what I try to comment on, too, in what I write.
Now, I think it was when you were flying missions during World War II that you first started to read poetry seriously.
Well, yes, I read a lot of things, and the prose things, novels and so on that I read had a certain quality that I liked. I could tell that I had rather read a writer named William Faulkner than one named James T. Farrell, who's a very prosaic and matter-of-fact and rather journalistic type of a writer. Then I sort of dimly recognized early on that there was some difference in kind between Faulkner and James T. Farrell. And I finally saw, after some time, that the quality that I wanted was more concentrated and better expressed in poetry than it was in prose fiction. So gradually I sort of gravitated over to poetry went with that more than I did any other kind of reading that I did.
Well, how did you end up reading more while you were flying missions during World War II?
Well, when you're overseas, you're in a squadron if you're not actually flying in combat missions and so on. You have a good deal of time. We had a squadron library. There was sort of a miscellaneous assortment of armed services editions and so on, and I read whatever was there and so on. And then when I got back from overseas in the early part of 1946, I had some money accumulated from being over there for a good while, and I went to New York and I just bought a lot of books and read them, you know, and everything just sort of built up from that.
Then you went back to college too, right?
Yeah, I started all over as a first-term freshman at Vanderbilt. I had been for a semester at Clemson, where I didn't take any interest in books or intellectual pursuits, poetry, anything else. I was strictly an athlete. I was kind of an average college football player, and not the best. I had my moments, but nothing, no superstar. But my main interest up to that time was sports. But the war changed everything, changed my values, and I came back, and I didn't go back to Clemson to play ball. I didn't have to play football anymore for a college education. I had the GI Bill, so I just enrolled as a freshman at Vanderbilt, which had a good intellectual and artistic tradition. I wanted what Vanderbilt had. I had no interest in what Clemson had.
When you say the war changed your values, what are some of the values that changed that affected how you lived your life afterwards?
I had the beginnings of a lifelong interest in the imagination and its works. Everything came out of those years. And when I went to Vanderbilt, I concentrated on that and went on from there.
Was it a different world, the world of literature,
from
the world of athletics that you were used
to? Yes, it certainly was different and unendingly fascinating. The more I found out, the more I wanted to find out. And it goes on today, as they say in the awful jargon of our time, as we speak.
Well, I'm sure the people were different, too, than the people who you had been used to?
Yeah, but I like them, too. I mean, I like football players and coaches and athletes and so on very much still. But my interest in them is relatively limited, and my connection with them and my social, concordance with them is relatively slight. But the main people that I find a rapport with are the people who are in some way in the arts. It doesn't have to be literature or poetry. It can be in a drama, it can be in a dance, music, and so on.
Did you find a way early on in your writing to write about the physical things that interested you?
No, I wrote about things that stuck in my mind. Very early on, I came to the as far as the choice of subject matter was concerned, my only rule of thumb is that if something keeps recurring to me without any apparent reason for it to keep coming back to my mind, then I know it's a potential subject because I can't get rid of it. I know that I have to deal with it. I have to write about it in some way, whether right or wrong, good or bad.
My guest is James Dickey. His new novel is called To the White Sea. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. James Dickey is my guest. Now, you worked in advertising for a while before you started writing full-time. What kinds of accounts did you have?
I started with Coca-Cola. Then I had various others. I moved to another agency where we had Lay's potato chips. That was before the fusion that created Frito-Lay. I did some bank advertising, and the last agency I worked for handled a Delta Airlines account.
Did you write any of the jingles or slogans?
I did. I wrote a lot of them. Some were used locally and some were used in other connections. I don't believe I'm at liberty to tell you which ones.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't think the company... I don't want the companies coming back at me or somebody else claiming they did it. I don't think that's important. Not anymore.
Did you make good money at it?
Well, more than I'd ever made before, but I was there 5.5 or 6 years, and I had a book of poems out and another one that was coming out, and I was given a Guggenheim Fellowship. And after one splendid conversation with my wife, we packed everything and the two children into the Volkswagen bus and went to go and live and work in the south of Italy, down south of Naples, in a little fishing village.
So that's when you started writing full-time?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had been writing a lot, though. I mean, I had... When I was in the ad business, I wrote in the evening and in the morning before I went to work. I wrote on the weekends. I wrote on vacations and going to sales meetings and whenever I could. Somebody asked me why wasn't it rather difficult to write poetry and the concentration that poetry demands under those conditions. And I said, no, I can write anywhere. Anybody who learned to write poetry on a troop train can write anywhere.
Right. I think you're probably best known for your novel Deliverance, and you also wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation. What was the inspiration for that story?
Well, I usually start anything I write with an image, as I said earlier, one of these obsessional images. I was sort of taking a siesta in Italy in 1962, and I saw, it just came to me, I had no intention that, my train of thought, such as it was not, didn't have anything to do with this, but I just saw a man standing at the top of a cliff. I didn't know how he had gotten there, whether he came from the woods at the edge, immediately the materialized woods in the picture. I didn't know whether he had just come out to the edge of the cliff and was looking around there, or whether maybe he had come up the cliff for some reason. What would be the reason? So gradually the story took hold of me, and in a few minutes, I don't know how many, but I knew the whole story. I knew who the people were going to be. I knew where it was going to take place. I knew what was going to happen to them, pretty much, and so on. And I just made some notes and went back to sleep, and everything started working out of that beginning.
I think the scene that made the biggest impact in Deliverance, the movie, and probably in Deliverance, the novel, is the scene where one of the characters is raped.
Well, that's famous. I can't really say justly famous, but famous it is. Bobby is the boy, the salesman, is the one that is the victim. That scene isn't necessary to the novel because the reader is going to want to see something terrible happen to that man that perpetrated the rape. Billy McKinney, who played him, and I thought he did a wonderful job. I would not be averse to saying that he was the best thing in the movie. Although I have great praise for everybody else in it too. I remember when he came up on the set and I said to him, Billy, Mr. McKinney, you have one function in this movie. That audience is going to have to hate you. He said, don't worry, Mr. Dickey, they're going to hate me. Have you ever seen anybody that you'd rather see get shot in the back with an arrow more than that guy? And so on. So he did very good. He did a good job on that. He was very convincing.
Do you think that part of what made the rape scene so shocking to audiences was the fact that it was one man raping another man?
Well, that's shocking enough. But the most shocking thing about it and the thing that makes you so disgusted and even terrified about it is the humiliation of the fat boy, you know, making him squeal like a pig and all that stuff. If you're going to assault somebody sexually, you don't have to do all that, you know. But the fact that he does it makes him singularly depraved and repulsive.
Do you think that this scene also, you know, played on people's fears of homosexuality?
That's not really what I had in mind at all. What I wanted to do was to have a scene which would... which would bring into focus the most abiding and the deepest fear of people in our time and our century, which is the fear of being set upon by malicious strangers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to happen off in the woods of North Georgia. It can happen on the streets of New York or any other city. To be assaulted by people who had just as soon kill you as look at you. In fact, some of them had rather. That's the fear of our time. And I wanted to use that that motif and as a lead-in to what happens in the rest of the story.
You know, I think that's a fear that most Americans live with, and you live with it in one way in a city and in a different way in the country.
It's much worse in the city because there's so many more people. But it's bad enough at any time or any place.
Mm-hmm. What kind of home do you live in now, and how close to nature are you?
Well, I live on a lake surrounded by woods, and there's a lot of wildlife there. I mean, just in the yard, we have rabbits, we have snakes, we've got all kind of birds. There's even an otter that lives in my backyard and swims in the lake. We call him the creature. And then I have another home at Paulus Island, which is very naturey, and so on. And then I get out in the woods as much as I can and just walk around. Sometimes I take a bow and you know, just to have one with me. I like having a weapon and so on. And I love archery. I love to shoot arrows.
Do you hunt?
I did a lot. I used to hunt a lot, but I don't do that. I think I may have gone on the last hunt already, but I still like to be out in the woods with a bow and the broadhead arrows. That's something that appeals to me to do.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
James Dickey's new novel is To the White Sea. This is Fresh Air. Thousands of people were killed in an earthquake in India. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Terry, we are getting as much reporting as we can from the scene and looking for eyewitnesses to talk about what it looks like now in the aftermath of the earthquake. We'll also be talking about changes in American foreign policy to tie our aid to trade, something that other countries do and the United States is about to begin doing. The Mercedes company is going to build a plant in the United States. That will be in Alabama. The aircraft manufacturer Martin Marietta, however, for the bad news, is laying off thousands of workers. We're also going to listen to some of the music, which is included in the magazine Dirty Linen.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says these days, young musicians are racing backwards through jazz history. Wynton Marsalis now plays swing trumpet like it's 1940. Marcus Roberts plays 1926 stride piano. Kevin says in the race to be retro, the player to beat is 20-year-old Chicago pianist Reginald R. Robinson. He skipped back to 1899, the dawn of the home piano craze of ragtime.
Composer and pianist Reginald R. Robinson knows exactly how classic rags are constructed. He builds his own the same solid way. Ragtime got its basic structures from the march. In a way, Scott Joplin's music is just a syncopated version of John Philip Sousa. The rag form is standardized enough to serve as a recipe, and Robinson can write authentic contrasting themes and fragmented bass lines to order. But his best pieces go further. His compositions are, well, forgeries. He's deliberately writing in a turn-of-the-century style. Like any good art forger, he immerses himself in the period aesthetic, lets that age's influences seep in. On Robinson's CD, The Strong Man, on Delmark, you can hear traces of spirituals and Chopin, sentimental airs and cowboy songs. This is from Ballerina Figurine. A forged painting may reveal itself after a few decades because the artist unwittingly suffused it with contemporary ideas. What passed for a Goya 60 years ago comes to look more and more like a painting from the 1930s. In Reginald Robinson's music, you can hear that dual perspective now. He not only knows where ragtime came from, but where it went, knows how it led to the streamlined stride piano of James P. Johnson, and then to mavericks who deconstructed that style, like Earl Hines and Thelonious Monk. In Robinson's piece, Just Try and Escape the Devil, the dissonant note in the melody, the clam if you prefer, sounds mild now, but would have been a shocker in 1903. I like how Robinson's seemingly unrelated opening and closing themes somehow fit together. Here's how the same piece ends. Ragtime left its mark on other music, too. On Stravinsky and Boogie Woogie, and the sort of rinky-dink jazz once heard in pizza restaurants. The old domestic parlor piano tradition, of which ragtime was one link, mutated into the very public art of Liberace, whose shtick suggested a rich culture buff conspicuously lounging at home, his bejeweled cape a gaudy bathrobe, and the candelabra just household bric-a-brac. The second theme of Reginald Robinson's A Troubadour Serenade could be Liberace tangoing Babyface. Reginald Robinson wrote 21 piano pieces for his first CD. A few have a perfunctory connect-the-dots quality, but that's all right. To say he's written only a handful of memorable rags by age 20 is not a put-down.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Seuss Bolin. Research assistance from Peter Clowney. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actors starring in new TV series. We'll feature interviews from our archives with Dennis Franz, now starring on NYPD Blue, and John Mahoney, the father on the sitcom Frasier. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.